Welcome to our presentation on the Sabbath. This is Romans 14, part 2. Our focus today is going to be primarily an evaluation of the Greek language and the Greek text of Matthew 15 and Mark 7 that deal with the question that the NIV and the NAS has answered as, in saying this, Jesus declared all meats clean. So we're going to take a look at that. And prior to that, we're going to take a look at English grammar so that you can understand through an analogy exactly how this is going to play out, because the NIV and the NAS have a correct translation, but it's not the only correct translation. And that's the key. So let's go ahead and begin. Our mission. We're going to start by taking a look at Matthew 15, verses 16 and 17 in the English and in the Greek. I'll point out some things in the Greek. Then we'll look at it in the Aramaic and in the Hebrew. Then we will go to Mark 7, 18 and 19 and look at it in the Aramaic. And then finally, we will look at it in the English and the Greek. All right, let's begin. Matthew 15 in the English and the Greek. I start with a note stating that the final three words of Mark 7:19 are missing in Matthew 15. This is how you can see the words here. These are the words that are in Mark. The first word is cleansing. Second word is all. Third word is the. And the fourth word is foods, plural. These four Greek words are missing in Matthew 15, the parallel passage. So as we go through the text of Matthew 15, you're going to see that there is no discussion or debate about that section. It's just not there. All right, KJV, Jesus said, "Are ye also yet without understanding? Do not ye yet understand that whatsoever entereth in at the mouth goeth into the belly and is cast out into the draught?" New American Standard, he said, "Are you still lacking in understanding also? Do you not understand that everything that goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and is eliminated?" Pretty clear. Let's take a look at the NIV. "Are you still so dull?" Jesus asked them. "Don't you see that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and then out of the body?" As you can see, very clear, everybody understands that it goes into the stomach and gets expelled out of the body, and they all have it correct. Now, the Matthew Aramaic, first we'll look at Etheridge. He said to them, "Do you also not yet understand? Know you not that whatsoever entereth the mouth, going into the belly, and from thence in purification it is cast without?" Pretty similar. Then Murdoch, and he said to them, "Are ye also up to this time without understanding? Know ye not that whatever entereth the mouth passes into the belly, and from there is ejected by purgation?" Interesting word choice. So as you can see, Aramaic is right in tune with the English. Finally, Matthew Hebrew, Shem Tov, he said, "Are you still without a mind?" Thought that was interesting. "Do you still not comprehend that everything that enters through the mouth merely goes to the belly and out through the natural opening?" This is a very literal Hebrew translation, but you get the point that they all are very, very close, and there's no discussion of controversy because the words in Mark 7:19, the last four, are missing. So let's go over now and take a look at Mark 7:18 and 19. First, we'll start with the Aramaic and we'll look at Murdoch. "Are ye likewise so undiscerning? Do ye not know that whatever from without entereth into a man cannot defile him? For it doth not enter into his heart, but into his belly, and is thrown into the digestive process, which carries off all that is eaten. That's how Murdoch in the Aramaic translates those last four words. Let's move to Etheridge. He said to them, "How dull are even you? Know you not that nothing from without that entereth a man can defile him, because it entereth not into his heart, but into his belly, and is cast out in the purgation, which all food purgeth." Huh. Again, interesting word choices. Now, the English KJV. "Don't you see that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and then out of the body? Because it entereth not into his heart, but into the belly, and goeth out into the draught, purging all meats." This is how the KJV translates those last four words, purging all meats. New American Standard. "And he said to them, Are you so lacking in understanding also? Do you not understand that whatever goes into the man from outside cannot defile him, because it does not go into his heart, but into his stomach, and is eliminated? Thus he declared all foods clean." So here you see the NAS, and the first time you're seeing the English translation of those last four Greek words. Let's move to the NIV. "Are you so dull?" he asked. "Don't you see that nothing that enters a man from the outside can make him unclean? For it doesn't go into his heart, but into his stomach, and then out of his body. In saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean." Once again, the NAS and the NIV have translated, and I've put it in yellow to highlight it so you can see. Now let's look at the Greek. And I've put the first three words in Greek in yellow to highlight because we're going to come back and refer to them. All right, now let's look at verse 19 and look at the last four words. "Cleansing all the foods." These are the two passages that are going to be important. The Greek, "and he said." That's the beginning of verse 18 and the end of 19. "Cleansing all the foods." Now, here's what I want you to notice. Not the last letter of cleansing, but the second to the last letter is, it appears in English, it looks like a W, an English W. It's really the Greek word omega. And this word cleansing, the case is nominative, masculine, singular. Very important. The key letter, I have highlighted it here so you can see the W, which is the omega. We're going to look at the considerations that are involved with this translation and these Greek words. First, language is important. When you're interpreting the biblical text, language is important. It is not the end all, but it is important. Textual variants must be considered. The reason why they must be considered is because you got to figure out which one is most likely the one that was originally written. Then you have to determine, well, why would somebody have changed it from that to something else? When did that change take place? Where did that change take place? What was the theological climate in which it took place? Were they battling some type of false doctrine? These things need to be considered, and they fall under the, I like to say, the category, textual variants. And in this particular case, they are the key to the translation. All right, number three, we have rules of grammar. Obviously, they must be considered. Four, context must always be considered when you're interpreting a text. Five, implications are important. Once you have come to a, you have begun to create an interpretation of the text, the interpretation is going to bring implications. You must consider the implications to determine of whether or not these implications can all be satisfied as true. If you have a dozen implications and none of them can be considered true, that's a hint that you need to go back and rework the interpretation. 6, historical setting is important. I'm just going to say that if you do not know what was going on at that time in that location, how can you ever hope to come to a clear understanding of the text? I'm just going to leave it at that. 7, parallel passages must be considered. If it shows up in one of the 3 synoptic gospels, and if it shows up in 2 of them or 3 of them, and sometimes passages from the synoptic gospels also show up in John, these parallel passages need to be considered. So I'm just saying. 8, past, present, and future events must be considered. You've got an interpretation. How do they fit the past, the present, and the future? Very important. 9, how the behavior of other key figures plays a role. There are key figures in the New Testament. We know what their behavior is because we have their words and we have their actions and we have third-party accounts of them. Sometimes we have their writings too, not of everybody, but of some. So we can figure out what their behavior was. And outside of the New Testament, we have historical documents that point back to some of the key figures. So we can support, even outside of Scripture, their behavior. You now have an interpretation that you are forming. Does the behavior of the key figures fall in line with your interpretation? Very important. And number 10, how does the behavior of the key figure play a role? In this particular case, we're talking about Peter, because Peter's mentioned in the parallel passage of Matthew 15. So he is a key figure. Also, another key figure is Yeshua. He's the one who's doing much of the talking. Not all of it, but much of it. And then there's the Pharisees. They are a key figure. We know a lot of things about the Pharisees. We know some things concerning the historical setting that the Pharisees were in during the time that Yeshua lived. And we have to consider them also as a key figure. So there you go. These are considerations. First, language is important. I want to state right up front that the New American Standard and the NIV translate their underlying Greek text according to the regular rules of Greek grammar correctly. Therefore, their translation is correct based on Greek grammar rules. They have a, not the, a correct translation. Jesus declared all meats clean, is a correct translation of the Greek grammar of the Greek manuscript that they use. Okay? The KJV translates their underlying Greek text according to the regular rules of Greek grammar correctly also. But you'll notice that the KJV had a different translation from the NAS and the NIV. Immediately, that begs the question, how can they both do it correctly following Greek grammar rules? Well, the answer is very simple. They have different underlying documents. And that leaps right off the page because they disagree. Okay, and this is where we get into textual variance. There are a number of manuscripts that show up, and this is what the NIV and the NAS use. Those manuscripts are older and more reliable. Notice the word for clean. Notice that I have highlighted the second to the end letter, omega, looks like a W, with white, over the yellow highlighted word for clean. And I have put what it is, the nominative masculine singular participle. The KJV follows a different manuscript known as the Textus Receptus. And you'll notice that the Greek word there, I've also highlighted the second to the last letter. In English, it looks like the letter O. And I've also put what it is, nominative neuter singular participle. This letter is known as omicron. The W in the Greek is omega. Looking at their types, nominative masculine nominative, neuter. Nominative, singular, participle are all the same, but the difference here is masculine and neuter. So if the older manuscripts that the NIV and the NAS follow has masculine, why did the editor of the Textus Receptus change it to neuter? The on-its-face meaning of the passage, it looks like Yeshua is talking about the elimination of the food that's eaten and it's sent off into the sewer system. Okay, that's what it looks like. If you examine the Greek nouns, those that are utilized to describe human waste are neuter. The impetus for changing the masculine form to read as a neuter would have been to clear up any ambiguity as to the subject of the participle. This is just regular rules of grammar. The participle and the subject. Certain things need to line up. And I'm going to show you some examples, okay? Because it applies in English. And you know it does. You don't think it. You just realize when you read it that that's not right. And then if you break it down, you'd get to a rule. All right, so I'm going to demonstrate that. But once again, let me say, we're talking about why did the editor of the Textus Receptus, which the King James Version was translated from, why would they have changed it from masculine to neuter? And it would be so that it would line up with the subject. And you'll see that as I break down more of the Greek. I've made a note here, and this is just so that you have as a reference, the earliest and most trustworthy manuscripts almost universally read the omega, which makes it masculine, and not the omicron, which would make it neuter. Now, we're going to get to where we're talking about. In this case, the closest antecedent masculine singular noun is latrine. So keep this in mind as we talk textual variants, because it sounds like this is where we want to go, but you're about to find out why you can't go there. 3, rules of grammar must be considered. Let's look at this from the standpoint of English first so that you can identify. Look at this sentence. She belonged to a club. If you were to read that or hear someone say that, you would think, well, obviously English is not their first language, because there's a problem with this sentence. Here's the same sentence fixed according to the rules of English grammar. She belongs to a club. All I had to do is add the letter S to make the sentence correct. But what if we change the she to they? Then what happens? They belong to a club. If it said they belongs to a club, that would be incorrect. So she requires the plural. They, which is plural, requires the singular. That's the rule. And you know it. You don't think it. But when you hear it, you know it's wrong or you know it's right. Let's move to example 2 within the English language. And once again, this is a very important concept that's going to play a role in us understanding the Greek situation. We have a rule that's called I before E, except after C. We've all heard that. So, let me ask you, what are these? Here are 16 words where it says I before E. And yet all of these words, the I is after the E, and there's no C involved. And yet all of these words are spelled correctly. So the rule doesn't apply to these words. So you would call it an exception to the rule. But let me put another exception up. What about these? I before E, except after C? But these have the I before the E after the C. So here's 5 more examples of words that are spelled correctly, which are another exception to the rule. So within the English language, and remember, I'm doing this as an analogy, so prepare yourself for the Greek when I go over there. In the English language, we can have a rule, but we can also have multiple exceptions to the rule. And here are 2 examples. Let's take a look at the Greek problem. Participles generally must agree in, and look at this list, gender, number, and case with the noun to which they attach. That's how people were able to take the Greek New Testament and translate it into English, because they knew the Greek rules. If you have a participle and you have a noun and they are attached, you know which ones are attached to which ones because they must agree in gender, number, and case. Now notice I've highlighted case here. In the phrase, look at this, the third word I've highlighted, which is the word for latrine, is in the accusative case. And there's other cases. There's the dative case and the genitive and some different things, different cases. But we're just dealing with the accusative and the nominative. In this phrase, the word for latrine is in the accusative case, while the participle, cleansing, is in the nominative case. So you can see that they do not agree according to case. I bet you're starting to get the picture of what's going on here now. Since thereby lies the problem, since the body doesn't clean all foods because, technically speaking, Greek grammar says they must agree in case, we need to find out who or what cleans the foods. How do we do that? Well, one of the things that we'll do is we will evaluate the early church fathers to see what they found, but we're going to have to get it from the rules of grammar. I'm just going to throw this in so that you can have it as a reference. Origen, who was in the early time period of the formation of the church, understood that Yeshua was the subject. And you can find that free online, commentary on Matthew book 11, section 12. Here is where it gets a little odd. This requires going back 38 words to find the matching nominative case word. Because remember, latrine was accusative. That was the case. But cleansing was nominative. So we need to go back and find the antecedent nominative word. And to find it, you have to go back 38 words. I had showed you this in the Greek when I put up verse 18. The first three words were highlighted. And it is, he said, which of course is Yeshua. So, since this is the first one going back, if Yeshua is the subject of the masculine participle, you get Yeshua cleansing all the foods. That is the correct Greek grammar. But then you have to ask a question. Well, how does Yeshua cleanse all the foods? Because he's not part of the body system. I mean, everybody has their own body. So how does he clean all the foods? Well, the only way that the translators could figure it out was by making all foods clean. Here's something that's important that we need to notate. They had a bias against the laws of Moses. And so this was a convenient translation because it met the rules of Greek grammar. And once they found something that was correct, they did not pursue any evaluation to see if it was correct context and all that other list that I just put up, which I'm going to go through each one at a time. They didn't do that. Because if they had, they'd have realized that the translation was incorrect. But because they were biased in their thinking, and they were quite satisfied that he set aside the law of Moses right here, you know, they're good to go. It fits. Greek grammar agrees. I'm done. Let's move on to the next passage. And as translations in the English go along, they eventually wanted to clean it up to make it as readable for English readers as possible. So they put in the word declared, which is kind of like an understood. Therefore, he declared all foods clean. That's how you get the translation of Mark 7:19. It is accurately correct according to Greek grammar, but not necessarily the only correct translation. Stay with me. If I have to summarize what is happening, based on the matching case, the NIV and the NAS have it correct. And the KJV has to be rejected because it uses an inferior manuscript. The textual variant used by the KJV, remember they replaced the Omega with the Omicron, is found to be inferior, should be rejected as a means to translate this passage differently from the NIV and the NAS because the manuscripts are much later. The ones the NIV and the NAS use are very early. The KJV, much later. as we saw, a scribe changed it to try to line it up to make it make sense. And, you know, we have multiple manuscripts that demonstrate that. Since we know that the NIV and the NAS, using Greek grammar, have translated this passage correctly, we're going to ask this question. Does Greek grammar give us any other options? The answer is yes. It is well known in Greek grammar that the nominative singular participle may sometimes refer to something within the previous context or to something implied in the context not explicitly mentioned, even though it may not be in the same grammatical case. Now, this quote comes directly from Tim Haig in his work, Mark 7:19, short note, where he has done the most of the work in analyzing the multiple manuscripts, the Greek grammars, breaking down the words, and this is an excellent source for those who want to pursue understanding this even more. Here are three examples with visual extracts. I'll explain these afterwards. I went to the library, I pulled three Greek grammars, and I found the sections that dealt with the use of gender and number and case, agreement and disagreement, and I photocopied the Greek rules so that you can see what I'm talking about. And remember, I just gave you an example. I before E, except after C. Yet, exception number one showed 15 words that didn't follow that, and exception number two showed you five more. I think it was 16 and five more. All right, so let's go. The first one will be from Dr. Moulton, the second one from Dr. De Bruyne, and the third one from Dr. Zierich. Here's the first one, A Grammar of the New Testament Greek by Dr. Moulton. And here you will see that I have highlighted in red and blue the section. I will read this in a section. Second, directly from the slides, I copied it out. The second Greek grammar of the New Testament and other early Christian literature, Dr. De Bruyne. Here I have marked once again with the red, showing what it says. This is two parts, and then there's a third part at the top. And here's the section we're interested in that deals with Mark 7:19. And like I said, I will have this in the slide. The last one is Biblical Greek by Dr. Zierich. And in section 15, he breaks down the passage. So let's take a look. Moulton, sometimes a positional phrases and circumstantial participles are found in the nominative instead of the oblique cases. Mark 7:19 is an example. This is the only instance which is important for exegesis. Some refer to Jesus, and that's Origen. I already gave you the location of that quote. However, others take it as a false concord. That is, others take it as not connecting properly case to case. They take it as being meant to agree with latrine and translate the latrine which removes filth. So it's a false concord. Number two, Dr. De Bruyne. The remaining instances are apositives or circumstantial participles in the nominative instead of an oblique case. Mark 7:19 is the reference. And number three, Dr. Zierich. The exegesis of a passage is affected by this tendency in only one case, namely Mark 7:19. Others, however, take cleansing with the omega as equivalent to cleansing with the omicron, referring to latrine, thus understanding into the privy which purifies all manner of food. So here's the conclusion from the Greek grammars. The need to understand the final clause of 7:19 as Mark's editorial conclusion is removed if, in fact, cleansing with the omega can have an antecedent with which it does not share grammatical concord. In other words, if cleansing does not have to agree with case, it doesn't have to go back 30-some words to Yeshua, it can agree with latrine. And the Greek grammars allow this exception. This allows the final clause of verse 19 to function normally as the conclusion of Yeshua's argument, namely, that as it pertains to food, what comes forth from the bowel does not defile, because it goes out into the latrine and is properly purged. Therefore, the rules of Greek grammar allow us the leeway to understand the passage without Yeshua doing away with the law. You that are listening, think. I before E, except after C. And then, that's the rule, and then there are sets of exceptions. Same thing here. Normally, they need to agree with case, but sometimes nominatives do not have to agree, or the word is a different case, or it's not even there, and it's something that it's implying. The Greek grammar allows us the exception. Therefore, while the NIV and the NAS have a correct translation, it's not necessarily the only translation or the correct translation. The correct. They have a correct, but not necessarily the correct. All right, let's move to number four. Context must be considered. The context here is clearly a discussion not about what's considered food, designated by that which is clean, and non-food, designated by that which is unclean. There's no discussion about food in this passage. So you have to read into the text about food. As a matter of fact, not only is it about not about food, but if you consider this, it's about whether one can eat at all if the ceremonial washing of the hands does not take place before eating begins. So it's not about the food. It's about, can you even eat? Everyone had been taught that minimum ritual defilement occurred frequently, and a simple washing of the hands would remove it. This would keep one from changing the status of food, which is those things designated clean, into a non-tor category of common, and thereby a food substance to be avoided, because you were ceremonially unclean. But it really is the word common, and that's where the confusion arises. Yeshua taught, and see, this is where he sets the record straight, nothing that goes into the mouth and into the stomach can make a person unclean. Not that the solution to the hand-washing tradition was to do away with the law of clean and unclean. He never goes there. He's dealing with a tradition that is incorrect. Now, number five, implications of the NIV and the NAS reading. Remember, I told you that once you have an understanding, once you have an interpretation, now you have to look at the implications of that interpretation. Number one, Galatians 4:4 states very clearly that Yeshua was under the law. He needed to obey it, or he would be committing a sin. Deuteronomy 4:2 states that we are not to add or take away from the commandments. Therefore, if he actually said this, then he just sinned. There are a lot of implications to that. Some will say, well, he could do that. Well, no, he couldn't. And here's why. Because if there was ever a case where he wanted to do away with the law, it was when he prayed, he said, Father, if it's possible, take the requirement of the law away that I need to go through this crucifixion, this sacrifice. He didn't want to go through it. He had a will that was 180%. 180 degrees out of phase of the Father's will. The Son was 180 degrees out of phase, exact opposite of the Father's will. And he prays, if it is possible for this law to be done away with, this requirement to be done away with, please do away with it. Then he said, but if it's not, then I'm going to go ahead through it. So if there was ever a case where he could do away with the law, that would have been it. And he couldn't. So there's no need to try to make a case that he could do away with whatever laws he wanted to do away with so that he never sinned. That is ridiculous, and you cannot make that case. Number two, just prior to this event, he stated that he did not come to do away with the law, yet the NIV and the NAS reading, the translation has him doing away with the law. That's an implication of their interpretation, their translation. Three, just prior, he stated that whoever taught others to not observe the commandments would be least in the kingdom of God. Guess what? He just put himself in the category of least in the kingdom. That's one of the implications of their translation. Four, just a few sentences earlier, he chewed out the Pharisees for setting aside the commandments of God. But now he's going to do exactly that? Questionable. Five, in the verses following, nobody takes note of the law being done away with. Not even a comment. Yet Yeshua gets right back on the topic he's been addressing from the beginning. Don't you think that's a little odd? He just did away with one of the most major laws that could be done away with, and nobody even goes, ding, ding, ding. Right. Number six, historical setting. What was the historical setting? We've got a meal with some Pharisees. What were the Pharisees doing? They were criticizing him for not teaching his students to follow man-made traditions properly. That's what this is about. Go back and read the beginning sections. He's criticizing Yeshua for not teaching his students, the disciples, to follow the man-made traditions properly. Why? Because they don't complain that Yeshua didn't do it. They say some, which is less than half, some of the disciples did not follow the man-made tradition. That means most did. Yeshua did, most did, some didn't. They're criticizing him for not teaching his disciples good enough that they all followed the man-made tradition. That's what this passage starts out about. Can you imagine if he actually said this and they had nothing to say about, oh, clean and unclean's gone? Oh, that's cool. Highly unlikely. Let's go to Yeshua's trial. Isn't it interesting that not a word is said about him doing away with any part of the law, including clean and unclean? Because that would have been a slam dunk. It's never mentioned. In the historical record of the conflicts in the first century, and you have to get this from outside of Scripture, you actually have to go read the history of the first century, there's not even a single mention of those things that were unclean and not usable for food as having been changed during and after the life of Yeshua. It never shows up in the historical record. Isn't that odd? The parallel passages. Matthew has the same story, but it's missing the final three words, which are at the center of the debate. The context of the story is the same. The section speaks clearly that the body expels the waste. 8. Past, present, and future. During the time of Moses, it is without debate that the laws of clean and unclean were on the books. During the millennial kingdom, part of the priest's work will be to teach the people the difference between the clean and the unclean. That's Ezekiel. So, what would be the reason to do away with it now just to bring it back then? That's a good question. 9. Remember I talked about the behavior of some key figures that are outside of this actual meal. Acts 21 demonstrates that James was proud of the tens of thousands that were zealous for the law. You can hear it in his tone. And he counted himself in with that group. Then he constructs a scenario where Paul can demonstrate that he's part of that group. Guess what? Zealous for the law includes clean and unclean. Therefore, key figures outside of this Pharisaic meal were still keeping clean and unclean. Interesting. Nobody knew. And number 10, there were key people, Yeshua, the Pharisees, and Peter. And I'm going to address Peter. Peter's at this event. You can see that from Matthew 15:15. He would have heard that the class of unclean had been done away with. What was his whole argument? He said, Yeshua comes in. Yeshua explains to the people. Then he comes into the building. Peter goes to him and says, hey, could you explain this more clearly? So he does. So he would have heard that unclean, everything is now clean. He guided Mark in the creation of his gospel. Mark's what we're looking at here. And he would have recalled such a landmark ruling by Yeshua. Yet, in Acts 10, he has no idea of this ruling. Is that even possible? You see what I mean about implications? So what are the conclusions? the weight of evidence. We understand that the New American Standard and the NIV translation of the last three words of Mark 19 as being correct to the letter of Greek grammar. That is a correct translation. However, the same Greek grammar allows us the leeway of sometimes recognizing that a lack of concord, in this particular case, agreement in case, does not necessarily blockade our path to the truth. Combined with the 10 points to consider, the weight of evidence is clearly on the side of no concord required. NAS, NIV, a correct translation? Yes. The correct translation? No. So there is a look at the Greek that has caused this major problem in Mark 7:19, how it's decided, but what they don't tell you is the exceptions to the rules so that you can see what another translation is and then evaluate the implications. So here is the end of part two. Thank you.